You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
In this grant, they are working with 9,000 students in 100 schools. The stimulus funds for broadband are responsible for transforming the limited and negative attitudes of these young people. I'll go on to discuss what it does for adults. The real heroes are those who compete for rigorous job training programs, those adults who take a risk and enroll in a digital literacy class in addition to having two or three low-wage jobs, and parents with low literacy levels who enroll in training because they think it will help their children have a better life. As of December 31st, the CETF 19 subrecipients have enabled more than 1,023 people to be placed in jobs and careers. We have trained more than 640,000 people in digital literacy skills from basic to advanced. And we have enabled more than 92,000 people to adopt broadband at home. In closing, let me just share a quick story about results and impact with another subrecipient, the Stride Center. Richard was on parole when he enrolled in the Stride Center Technical Training Program. Unable to provide for his family, Richard came to the Stride Center for a new beginning. He not only gained employable technical skills, he learned how to interview for a job, dress professionally, and project a professional demeanor that later enabled him to land a full-time job as a technician for AT&T. Richard is one of the 2,300 students the Stride Center trained, providing pathways toward economic self-sufficiency. The Stride Center graduates find jobs, 80% of the Stride Center graduates find jobs. In Richard's words, "It never occurred to me that I could have a career in anything at all. Now I make a good living, my family is proud of me, and I can see a positive future. I could not have done any of this without the support, guidance, and training from the Stride Center."
Thank you, Susan. Susan's bio and the other panelists are included in the handout that is on the table. So in the interest of time, you can refer to that for background on the panelists. Mark?
Thank you, Tony. I also wanted to extend thanks to the Department of Commerce and to the Advisory Committee to the Congressional Internet Caucus for hosting this conference. It's certainly a pleasure of mine to be here today representing our BTOP project and also participating on this panel with the rest of the panelists. Should be an interesting discussion as we work through the next hour. I'll tell you a little bit about SDN, maybe give you some context about the company, and I think that'll lead into a little bit of the discussion on our project. Now, SDN, we're headquartered in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We're owned by the independent phone companies in South Dakota, and we operate a middle-mile network in the state of South Dakota, and that network also extends into the neighboring states. So if you're familiar with the central part of the United States, we run from Casper, Wyoming, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then we started Fargo, North Dakota, run south down to Omaha, Nebraska. And the state of South Dakota really sits right in the middle of those four cities, and that's where our primary network exists. We've been providing connectivity to community anchoring institutions and large enterprises for about a dozen years. So when the BTOP project came along, we saw this as a way to stimulate some of the activity and connectivity to some of the sites that were, I'll say, really without the federal funding, might not have been touched for perhaps another dozen years in terms of fiber optic facilities. I know many of you here are in the regulatory field, policy field. I would say SDN and its independent phone company owners, just from a standpoint of giving you some background, our regulatory and policy positions are generally outlined best by NTCA and OPASCO. So those might be organizations you're familiar with here in Washington. But a little bit about our project. It is a middle-mile project. In total, it's $25.7 million. $20.6 million came from grant funds, and we matched that with an additional $5.1 million in funds. We broke ground in August of 2010. We were one of the first in the country to break ground under the BTOP and BIP programs. My understanding is there were a few of us breaking ground in the month of August, and who was first, I don't know, but I just know we were one of the first. But our project has four primary elements, and I'm just going to touch on those and again to give you a little bit of background that may help lead to some of the questions. We're building over 350 new miles of fiber in our state, and that's intercity fiber. But keep in mind, we had an existing network. So part of what we're doing is filling in some of the holes that our existing network we hadn't had the resources to build up to this point. But then we're also touching over 300 new community anchoring institutions. And there was a wide definition of community anchoring institutions in the NOFA, and our focus has been on the institutions that we had the most history with, which were schools, rural health care facilities, state, federal, and local office buildings, and then a variety of public safety locations, which could include sheriff's offices, police offices, communication towers operated by our state and local governments as well to help provide communication to responders. The third area of our project was really to expand capacity on the existing network, which was designed to help support the demand that would be placed on that network coming from the 300 new community anchoring institutions that we'd be adding to the network. And then finally, I think one of the things that I'm really most proud of, and it's just now getting underway, we had in our project, we had spec'd out the modernization of a telecommunications training laboratory at the Mitchell Technical Institute in Mitchell, South Dakota. That school, it's primarily a 2- and 3-year school, provides technical training to telecommunications technicians and satellite communication technicians. Like many schools, perhaps the equipment was beginning to age while the technology was advancing. So in our grant, we laid out as part of our proposal to put $1 million of new equipment in that lab. Those dollars are being spent now into that lab. We're starting to put the equipment in during this spring semester at their school. And the idea was to get the equipment in, we'll get the faculty trained throughout the spring semester and across the summer, and they'll be integrating that new equipment and those perhaps new classes or new aspects of classes in their fall curriculum. The student body's helping with the installation, helping with the turn up of the equipment. But in the end, what we'll have is a training ground in our state that will be able to provide trained technicians to come out not only to SDN, but to other wireline and wireless telecommunications providers who are trained on the most current equipment. I think the most perhaps interesting part of that, the part that was of most important to the grant, was that they'll be trained on the equipment that's being deployed in the grant. So we'll have the technicians, in addition to our own staff, who are trained, but new technicians coming into the workforce every year that are trained on the equipment that we are deploying under the grant. A little bit about our current status. Tony, we are on time. We are on budget. We are delivering the intent of the grant. The community anchoring institutions that we've touched, and to date, and I had a put a sheet on your at your seats, touched nearly 230 community anchoring institutions. Generally, within 60 days of the fiber being placed at those sites, we're finding the turn up of the services. The schools are the sites that are really on top of the game, in terms of probably the quickest turn ups. As soon as it's there, they're usually back in place with orders, turning up services within 2 weeks of the deployment of the fiber facilities. Followed probably most closely by the rural healthcare providers. Seems like the state and local governments, there's been a little more, I'll say, budget consciousness that they've had to work through, kind of timing different budgets. So that's the status of our project, and I look forward to questions as we get through the rest of the panel.
Thank you, Mark. Before we move on to Jim, I want to take everyone's temperature. Mark introduced this term, middle mile. Does everyone know what that means, middle mile connections? Anybody need a definition? you might scratch their heads. Most of our investments are actually not funding last mile. We're actually not connecting homes and businesses directly. What we're doing with most of our funds is we're bringing these fat pipes into communities. We're directly connecting schools and hospitals and government facilities. And our requirements provide an opportunity for last mile providers to connect into these fat pipes to provide more affordable service to last mile providers. So what we know is in harder to serve communities, one of the principal barriers to providing the last mile connections that folks need is that there is an adequate middle mile that's affordable that folks can connect into. So those are the investments we made that's going to prime the pump for significant private sector investment downstream. And so is that clear to folks? So we're not actually funding BIP. A lot of the BIP projects at RUS are funding the last mile piece. NTIA is funding the middle mile piece. So it's really critical infrastructure for many communities across the country. So Joe, you want to take off from there?
Yeah. Thanks, Tony. And thanks, everyone, for attending this session. And thank you for having us here. MCNC is a 30-year-old nonprofit organization, a private nonprofit. And like many states, North Carolina has a high-speed optical backbone that services mainly community anchor institutions and mainly those in higher education. So that's basically our purpose. We were incubated 30 years ago to bring technology economic development to Research Triangle Park. And in fact, we're very successful in that research and economic development mission. But we also had a secondary mission, which was to operate a network that served the institutions of the University of North Carolina system. At the time, 30 years ago, that was a microwave infrastructure. See how far the world's come, and data over copper. Now that would probably be woefully inadequate, and I'm sure it would be. The focus of MCNC over the last 10 years has really honed on operating the network. And today we operate a network called the North Carolina Research and Education Network. It is a high-speed optical statewide backbone that serves the following: all 17 institutions of the University of North Carolina system. And for those of you that enjoy Carolina basketball, for our purposes, Duke and Wake Forest were considered part of the UNC system, so they were served as part of. So you have Chapel Hill and Duke on the same network, being treated the same way. All 58 North Carolina community colleges, all 2,410 K through 12 schools in the state, 26 K through 12 charter schools, 27 of 36 independent colleges and universities, 30 nonprofit, mainly rural hospitals, and 55 county health agencies and publicly run free clinics. If it was still a holiday season, I'd also say we have a partridge in a pear tree. Well, in 2007, we began to look at the service population and realized that our constituents, particularly in rural North Carolina, were growing their bandwidth use by 40 to 50% annually. We were using more digital education. Healthcare was becoming increasingly delivered over internet infrastructure. And those things were leading to a fact that within 5 years, we would outstrip the fiber capacity of rural North Carolina. Instead of just focusing on servicing our anchor institutions, though, we realized that we needed to fill a gap, a public-private gap. Because if we were going to look at digital education growing to being 50% of our curriculum, it wouldn't make sense if half the children in a rural classroom went home and didn't have broadband at home. If we were looking at changing the face of rural healthcare, where we spend a lot of our money on rural populations, it wouldn't make sense not to be able to monitor those patients at home and monitor their vitals. We needed to think about building an infrastructure and investing in an infrastructure with a private nonprofit in the center and private sector for-profit companies that would scale well beyond 768K to the home, 250K, 768K down and 250K up, and our community anchor institutions undefined of what broadband service would be, to a future where more and more and more was done online. 30 to 40% growth rates a year. So we built two public-private partnerships, one for the first round of BTOP funding, one for the second round of BTOP funding. We were able to secure two rounds of funding, $140 million total, $104 million from the NTIA, and about $40 million from private sector resources that we raised on our own, including $8 million from our own endowment. And today we are in the throes of building 2,600 miles of continuous fiber optic infrastructure that touches 83 of 100 counties in North Carolina. We've been highly successful in this build. The private sector has benefited greatly from it. We are more than halfway finished, almost complete with the first round bill, about 9 months ahead of schedule, I think, Tony, and about halfway complete with the second round bill. 1,700 miles of the 2,600 is new. It is infrastructure that didn't exist. For 900 miles, we looked at the assets of incumbent carriers, small telecoms in North Carolina, small cable companies, electric membership cooperatives, and didn't overbuild any of the assets that they had in place, but actually leased fiber from them, and then just filled in the gaps with the 1,700 miles new. This has been a boon to North Carolina. $143 million of the $144 million goes direct to spending with private sector companies, with optical equipment manufacturers, engineering firms, manufacturers of cable and conduit, and other companies have benefited, mainly the North Carolina economy. We're very proud of where we are right now. About half of the first round build is in service. We're providing new connectivity to East Carolina University Med Center and about seven hospitals in rural North Carolina that would have never been able to participate in digital healthcare without them. That's just one example. What I'm most concerned about is the third grade girl on Cape Hatteras who needs internet access at home in order to dress up a PowerPoint for she and her classmates. Not only did we take care of that young girl's need at school and did that for the future, but we're also going to have a big opportunity to take care of her internet access at home by doing exactly what Tony mentioned, which is lowering wholesale costs in the middle mile to incent carriers to build more last mile infrastructure. We'll get more into the personal stories, but again, very highly successful and have spent probably about $80 million of our $140 million allocation and put it back into the North Carolina economy.
Music to my ears. Bill?
Hi. Let me echo the gratitude for the chance to talk to you folks expressed earlier, both to the folks at NTIA for inviting me to be on the panel and for the sponsors of this conference for creating the opportunity. The project that I work for kind of returns to the area that Susan was describing, slightly different model, different kind of setting and different kind of approach, but it's the same basic goal, which is to address the fact that as we network the entire world and all the functions in it, it becomes no longer a matter of preference or a matter of convenience. It becomes a matter of necessity for individuals living in that world to be able to negotiate it through the network. And that is just as true of low-income 45-year-old adults who have been laid off from warehouse jobs in Cleveland, Ohio, as it is for folks in coming out of universities looking for jobs in the new economy. In fact, all jobs are now in the new economy. Before I came to work on this project, for one community, which I'll describe in a second, I spent about 5 years working for a coalition of community technology organizations in the city of Cleveland, and I sat, borrowed a desk from the local workforce agency and sat in between two of their best job developers. I don't know if people know what that job is, but everybody in Cleveland knows what a job developer is. A job developer is the person who actually sits down with you and helps you figure out how to connect your life to a company that's still hiring. And what I discovered is over the course of those 5 years, the advice that these job developers were giving their clients changed from a very, very energetic physical approach to getting out to every company and putting your resume in and getting to know people and showing up at the HR office, and changed dramatically so that by the end of this process, which was 4 or 5 years ago, the first three questions asked to every single person who came in were, do you have an email account? Do you have an electronic resume? Do you know how to do an online search? There's a huge cultural change in the most basic part of the fabric of development and future building in the city of Cleveland and Detroit and every place else. That question of whether you can somehow take the life that you've built around other modes of doing business and convert it into what's now become the new economy. even if all you're looking for is a chance to clean up at the warehouse on the second shift. So one economy, to return to that, subject for a second, is an organization in some way like the one that Joe just described on a different kind of regional scale. The organization started 8 years ago with some dark fiber. It was created by some thought leaders and institutional leaders in the city of Cleveland, and its goal was to create a network capacity for nonprofit and public organizations that would enable that network capacity to be the engine for development strategy in the city. And over the course of the last 8 years, the organization has grown to the point where it is now running fiber to nonprofit and public institutions, really driven by schools and hospitals primarily, in about 26 counties, counting the places where we are already connected on the network that's now being built. Even before the NTIA program took off, one community was an important presence in seven counties, had provided broadband for schools, I believe, in four of them, was doing an FCC-driven hospital project, hospital connection project, and in many ways was doing exactly what its founders intended. But the strategic proposition for the founders of One Community was a three-step approach to the problem. First build, then enable, then transform. And while it's easy enough in the, not easy enough, but straightforward enough in the public and nonprofit sector to build, and it's just a question of, you know, raising money, getting the agreements, finding the customers, the question of enabling those institutions to actually be able to use that capacity so that then transformative uses would begin to be common in the community, that's a much more difficult proposition. And within the institutional the organizations themselves, the user organizations, they, of course, all have their own strategies. But when you look at that in the community at large, in a city like Cleveland, it's clear that one of the audiences that has to be enabled is the lowest income cohort of the residential population, because those are the actual constituents of many of the anchor institutions. They're going to be the customers of such a network. So about 4 years ago, One Community began looking for ways to partner with community organizations, first in Cleveland and then some other organizations, to develop models to enable people who are disconnected in low-income communities and constituencies not only to have a capacity to help people learn to use computers and the Internet, but to do that on a scale that would actually have an impact on those constituencies or communities. And when the VTOP program emerged, we put in a proposal together with actually not just in Cleveland, but in Cleveland, several nearby communities in Northeast Ohio, some Appalachian counties in the central part of Ohio, and then with partner organizations in some other cities, including Detroit, Lexington, Kentucky, Winston-Salem, and some of Joe's good friends at Wake Forest, and some folks in Florida as well. And the purpose of the proposal, which we called Connect Your Community, was to create and demonstrate an approach to assisting mass adoption of computer technologies by people who were previously disconnected for all the reasons that the FCC and the NTIA have exhaustively documented, to help that to happen, to help it happen at a scale that would actually enable people to look at that experience and come out of it and say, okay, we've actually demonstrated the return on investment to institutional and public partners from doing this. We've created a new kind of social network capacity in communities to provide back support for more people to adopt. And we've been able to do this in a way where the costs and the actual processes are predictable, and therefore other people can take them home and use them, right? And that's really the purpose of the Connected Community Project. So I just named the communities we're involved in. We received one of the bigger grants in the first round of the BTOP round. Received $19 million from the federal government, matched that with $6 million from local sources. And our goal over the course of a three-year contract is to directly train about 34,000 adult individuals, have at least 26,000 of them actually become broadband adopters in a way that we can personally account for, right? That we know these people and what they've done and how they've done it, and that at least three-quarters of them will actually have subscriptions to private systems, although, in fact, most of them will, right? And so we are now about 60% of the way through that process. We've spent a little less than 60% of our money. I keep struggling with NTIA over the fact that it doesn't help them, right, if we're efficient, right, because part of the point of this is to create economic impact. But we're employing about 105 people in the 8 communities. Those 105 people are doing what people are very experienced at doing in low-income communities, which is managing outreach, training, and community support programs. In the course of doing that, they're being employed for at least 2.5 years so that we're meeting the needs of the stimulus program. They're also becoming much more experienced community leaders in supporting and strategizing for deployment of technology within their own communities. And then we are going out to what's now about 275 separate sites in the 8 communities across the eastern part of the United States. And they are all kinds of sites. They're traditional community computer centers. I don't know if most people in the room know that there is such a traditional thing, but there is. There were 20 of them in Cleveland when we started this process. But also Grange Halls and community college classrooms and workplaces like Wake Forest. Wake Forest Hospital is actually doing CYC classes for its own employees. And in a whole lot of other ways, we're just grinding it out. People are going out, bringing people into classes, training them. Part of the training is to help them discover something they really want to do with the network and train them to do that so they go home with that knowledge. And then the last 2 hours of the class is talking about affordability issues. We're able to assist people to some extent with subsidies, but for the most part, they have to figure out for themselves how to take the value of the proposal and monetize it in their own lives, right, as a value proposition. And for the most part, what that means is that once people know what it is they're going to get out of this, they go home and they get an AT&T account, a Time Warner account, a Comcast account, because they have figured out how to make that central to their lives. So that's our basic project. As I say, our goal was 26,000 folks trained, or 34,000 folks trained. We're above 20,000 now. We'll conclude the project sometime next summer, and we hope we'll be able to report some major changes. We can talk a little bit about individual stories later.
Thanks so much, Bill. Andrew represents our third bucket of investments. Remember at the beginning, I talked about our sustainable broadband adoption investments. We spent about $250 million in that area. And Susan and Bill's projects represent our adoption projects, about $3.5 billion in our middle mile infrastructure investments. And now we spent about $200 million including a grant to the city of Philadelphia to promote access to broadband in public places. So, Andrew, over to you.
Thanks, Tony, for having me here today. I'm from the city of Philadelphia. We have a rather substantial technology access and adoption challenge there, particularly in our low-income communities. And that was kind of the context behind applying for this Public Computing Center's grant. It's a $6.4 million grant. And just as kind of backdrop again, there's also an organization in Philadelphia that won sort of a sister adoption grant for about $11 million. That organization is the Urban Affairs Coalition. So if you ever hear the term Freedom Rings Partnership, that's what that refers to. It's kind of the linking term for both grants. And we do work together pretty closely on both grants, and the idea is that they provide some of their programming in our sites. So it's worked out pretty well. So as far as our grant specifically, I'll just give you a quick overview and then give you a sense of where we are today. And then I'd like to end just with a really quick, nice story, I think, of community building that's happened as a result of our grant. So ultimately, we'll have 77 computing centers. We have only 9 to go, so we're about 68. The money in the grant essentially pays for the technology infrastructure at the site, the technology support at the site, staffing across the whole grant, and then there's also a component to evaluate the program, and that's sort of starting now, about midway through. I think one of the things that's interesting specifically about our grant is that we have a staff person at every site. So there are 77 of these part-time computer assistants, as we're calling them. And that's proven really effective and necessary in the sense that they're always there. They can do kind of tier one support, both for the PCs, but also help people who come in and just don't even know how to use a mouse, because we have a lot of people like that in Philadelphia, a great challenge. So our centers are located in relatively diverse places. So we have a lot of them in recreation centers. We have a lot in community organizations. We have them in transitional housing facilities. And then there are also 2 mobile units, one of which is going to be, should hit the ground in March. It'll be operated by the Free Library. We're calling it the Techmobile, so that should be kind of an interesting twist to this. I think our partners probably are equally as diverse as our locations. In addition to Parks and Recreation and the Free Library, there are also 4 different community organizations, and they all have really diverse missions. So I think one of the sort of accidental genius aspects, I think, of this grant was that we were able to hit a whole bunch of different populations who have really low internet access rates through these 4 different partners. So anything from transitional and homeless housing issues, health, specifically HIV and AIDS. Another is a workforce development organization. And then the 4th is kind of a media production youth empowerment group. So pretty nice range of groups, I think. And then I guess maybe it's worth saying just how we're administering this. So in Philadelphia, we have an inspector general, obviously, but we also have what's called an integrity officer that's appointed by the mayor. They're kind of at the top of the organizational structure, and they help us a lot with some of the compliance issues that we have with the grant. The city also has a recovery officer specifically that's in charge of sort of coordinating and managing all the different stimulus funding efforts that are going on in the city, because it's not just the broadband stimulus, but there are all sorts of different funding opportunities there. She also produces a really nice book of what's going on in Philadelphia for recovery funding, and we sent some of those to our federal program officer, and they are apparently lost in the mail, so I cannot give them out to you. I apologize for that. But, you know what that says about full stops at this point. So below that, then, is kind of the grant administrators for the city, and then it goes down to the subrecipients. So our 6 partners, or as we call them, the managing partners, each have their coordinators, managers. So that's kind of the structure. So as far as where we are now, we started opening these about 9 months ago in March of 2011. We have 68 open. It's about 700 new workstations, somewhere in that ballpark. And as far as usership, it's really been overwhelming, as someone has mentioned earlier. This is for the quarter ending in September, so July, August, September. We're still tabulating numbers for the quarter that just ended in December. But as far as last quarter, we were averaging about 5,500 5,500 a month. And what's happened, the recreation centers, and there were about 15 of those open now, those have actually blown past those numbers just for 1 month. So in the month of October, the recreation centers served about 5,000 people themselves. That's kind of an interesting one, I think, because the recreation centers don't really have that existing programming going on like a lot of the social service agencies do. So to me, that really shows the need to a great extent, because it's really just people coming in off the street to use the PCs and get the internet access and the training programs that we offer. There was a population going to rec centers that would go and play basketball or do sports programs, but that was really what was going on at the recreation centers. So it's been really overwhelming in terms of usership so far. And then I guess I could mention jobs, because that was a big part of the stimulus funding, obviously. At this point, we have about 11 full-time jobs and 60 part-time jobs. And those 60 part-time jobs are the computer assistants that I mentioned. And then finally, the one thing we're going through now is kind of a rebranding effort. So we were called the Freedom Rings Partnership. We're now going to be called Key Spots. So we've again leveraged some of the adoption money to have a firm come in and do some branding for us to attract more people to the centers. So it's going to be called Key Spots. It's nice orange and blue colors and that sort of thing. So that's kind of where we are with the grant. And I think one nice story that's developed, and I think it's going to be a theme through a lot of these probably, is that we've created new communities. And that's really exciting, I think, in Philadelphia. So as an example, one of our partners, who is the Media Mobilizing Project, runs a site that is kind of loosely affiliated with the Unified Taxi Workers Alliance. It basically, before the site, was just a building where taxi drivers could come in, use the restroom, hang out, socialize, whatever taxi workers do. Since then, they put in a site, a lab, and for some reason, a very large Bengali community has begun to use the PCs. And they bring their families, they Skype back home, they have their kids take the classes, and actually the challenge has now become finding someone who can teach computer skills in Bengali. So I have no explanation for why this very interesting community has happened, but I think it's really a result of this money and our specific site there. So I suspect we'll have a lot of these kinds of stories echoed as we hear from more of you today.
Thank you, Andrew. I want to come back to our to Mark and Joe for a minute. And something you said earlier, Mark, really struck me, which is I think what you said was, you know, but for these Recovery Act investments, it may have been a decade, you know, before some of these communities actually saw an upgrade in their service. And when you think about how we're falling behind, you know, other parts of the world in terms of our broadband, that's just such a striking statement to think that how far behind some of our communities would be for these investments. So I wanted you all to talk a little bit more about how, in your view, these middle mile investments are making a difference, providing the kind of adequate service that, you know, our schools and our hospitals need to be competitive today, and what this means from a private sector perspective, because we really are priming the pump for significant private sector investment down the road. Can you say a little bit more about, you know, what these investments are doing in your communities?
I can certainly talk for our project in South Dakota. About 10 years ago, the governor put T1s to all the schools to bring internet to all the schools on a unified basis. You know, so that everyone, we didn't have the, I'll call it the more urban districts. And in a state like South Dakota, you got to understand what urban means, right? We're 800,000 people spread across 80,000 square miles, and a third of our population, if not more, sits in three counties. All right, so that's a handful of school districts that make up probably 40% of our population. The rest of the population, the other 63 counties, would make up that 500,000, 450,000 people. But it's those communities where we'll find the independent phone companies, I'll say my ownership, served them. But you had other companies over the years that may have had not been making the technical upgrades in some of those areas. We really took the position of, South Dakota's our home state. We adopted the state, and we've been trying to bring that level playing field of technology to all the communities in the state. Things outside of our service territory and places that are inside of our service territory. So we've taken the fiber to the schools and taken the fiber to a variety of places. But we still have a couple of rural counties that we needed to touch, or counties that we needed to pass through to start to touch some schools and hospitals along the way. But when talking about teachers and in the school districts, you know, we're able to, what we do is unify a set of video classes across the state. So school districts with more resources than other districts can provide online classes. My sons take Latin. They get to take it from a teacher, but that same teacher provides Latin classes across the state, across the video network. Same is done with physics in a lot of the smaller school districts. So it's a way to bring educational resources to smaller communities where they couldn't do it before. Maybe the school district budget didn't allow for it. It allows for better utilization of dollars that go into education by using the network. And similarly with healthcare, we're able to put hundreds of patients a day in front of dozens of doctors. You know, in being a rural state, attracting doctors to rural parts of the state is difficult. We can attract them to a community like Sioux Falls or Rapid City, but then we need to put them in front of those patients that are in those smaller communities. And by cutting down the transport times between the rural community and the doctor sees the patient more often, the patient generally responds better to the treatments. Treatments aren't working, they can put that, they can change those treatments along the course. It also reduces then the cost of healthcare delivery in those rural parts of the state. And it also, it takes stress off of families because they don't have to transport that person perhaps 150 or 200 miles to that specialist. They take them to a clinic that might be 30 miles away, get them in touch with that specialist. And it also keeps them in their jobs, those family members, keeps them in their jobs rather than transporting their loved ones. So those are some examples of how I think how the network is expanding in our state and how it's being used in our state. Joe?
Tony, Mark outlined the great practical applications and what happens with different service constituents. I'll talk a little bit more about the marketplace when I chat. I think it's important to understand that we're talking about, in North Carolina, we have the second largest rural population in the United States to Texas. And our rural population actually grew 10% between the 2000 and 2010 census. We almost have 3 million people in rural North Carolina. There's a market there to serve. But I think we all need to be realistic about how a publicly traded telecom company differs from a small independent or association of co-op telephone companies. Those large Wall Street traded companies have to show an 18 to 24 month return on capital. An 18 to 24 month return on capital is never going to work when you're talking about rural densities. So you have got to put some seed investment in there and some of this wholesale and middle mile infrastructure in order to seed broadband long term. And then those small independent telcos, the electric membership co-ops, the cooperative telephone, the telephone co-ops will build off that rural infrastructure in order to reach last mile constituents. Those smaller independent entrepreneurial telecom companies are looking at more like a 5 to 10 to 15 year return on capital. You are never going to break the marketplace by relying on the incumbents to come in and build rural infrastructure. It's just not going to happen. I've learned enough about this business now, and I'm part of this business. Even though we're a nonprofit, we're part of this ecosystem now with rural fiber capacity to ever see them build out infrastructure in these areas. They have benefited greatly from our work in education. North Carolina today takes down double the amount of E-rate money that we did 5 years ago. The reason for that is because NC Ren came in, opened up a huge pipe that a school district can use, and forced all the districts to upgrade their land. Most of that upgraded land business went to AT&T, Frontier, CenturyLink, and Time Warner. There's got to be an incentive to build that infrastructure, an economic incentive, but the way we're going to reach those citizens in rural areas is to be smart about understanding the economics of this business and attacking parts of the ecosystem of the economics of this business. And that's exactly what the NTIA has done with this $3.5 billion investment in rural middle-mile infrastructure. They have made it easier to deploy service. They have changed the equation because they've taken some of the capital investment up. And what you're going to see eventually over the next 10 to 15 years is you're going to see rural telecoms, small entrepreneurs, who see a competitive wholesale market like they've never seen it before. It changes the economics of how they can deliver service, and they're going to be able to expand their service territory with innovative fiber-to-the-home technologies, with innovative wireless technologies, all of those things. So, Tony, that's the way I believe that this investment is going to play out. And I think it was a very key investment and actually a very wise investment of the place in the marketplace to hit.
Great. Thanks so much, Joe. I want to get Susan back in the conversation here. She has some really good data. I'm looking over her shoulder. I did want to repeat again that our latest Digital Nation study shows that over 30% of households still don't have broadband, they still have not subscribed to broadband. So I wanted to get Susan and Bill back into the conversation, Andrew, to talk about why is it so imperative that these households subscribe to broadband? Why is this an imperative in our society today? And what are they missing out on by not having broadband, by having to wait in line at these libraries to get, you know, 30 minutes worth of service a couple times a week? Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Susan, or Bill, either one, Andrew?
Well, I guess one point I'd like to make is Tony's describing a phenomenon that, again, people may or may not be familiar with, but in communities, particularly African-American communities in cities around the country, it is a common phenomenon for the public library to have, you know, a local branch might have 4 or 5 computers, a technology center might have 15 or 20, and they'll have a period during every day when people can sign up to use it. And, you know, there's a period when kids can do it, but adults also use it. I believe that the city of Chicago did a study about 3 years ago that was kind of a prelude to the VTOP project there, and reported, they actually were able to do, I think, about 10,000 interviews in the city. It was very, very granular. And what they discovered, among other things, was that in low-income African-American communities, the percentage of the population that was using libraries or community centers to access the internet was on the order of 20%. Right? It was huge. And you can see that in Cleveland, in Detroit, in Philadelphia, I'm sure, and everywhere else, in the fact that the common phenomenon is huge waiting lists to use those library computers. The significance of this, of course, is that people know that it's very important for them to be online. They aren't going there. They may be going there to update their Facebooks, right? But they also, to a large extent, are going to look for work, right? And yet, for some reason, they have not gotten that broadband connection at home to do it. And that's actually kind of the central problem of the adoption program, is making that conversion. The data that has been done first by the Pew Internet Center and then more recently by FCC and by NTIA using census data shows really clearly that there are at least 3 major reasons why people who aren't just totally disinterested in internet service don't have it at home. One of those reasons is lack of knowledge about how to do it. A related knowledge is fear of doing it. There are other, you know, things that people have heard bad about the internet. And then the third reason is affordability. I just can't afford it. So we don't so much in our program try to persuade people that it's important for them to have the internet, because it seems to us that that message has pretty much gotten across. Right? The problem is to get at those obstacles to adoption for people who already get it, get the need. And it's very important to realize that if you've looked for a job, you know what the need is. If you have a kid in school, you know what the need is. In Cleveland, anyway, those are the 2 big sectors of people we're trying to address. So this is really more about how do we get over the affordability issues and the issues of, I just don't know anything about it. I don't know how to get started. I don't have any friends who can show me. And one other thing I mentioned in thinking about this that I think is important to remember strategically, how we all got on the learning curve for being at least good lay users of broadband and applications almost always has something to do either with work or with school. Right? This is, you know, for families working in school, right? And a very large part of what we're trying to deal with in the adoption programs is the fact that you have large communities of people for whom that particular avenue has never opened up. Right? You can go up and down the streets in some neighborhoods in Cleveland, and if you find 3 people on a block, leaving aside the vacancies, that are internet users, you will be doing well. The social network is not providing that support. So a lot of what we're doing with community adoption is creating that network exactly the way Andrew was describing for the Bengali community. I guess I think it speaks to, I hope, to your question. I think that we know that we need to convince anybody anymore. The world is showing people on TV and in at the unemployment office how important this is. The question is more, how do we identify the obstacles and overcome
them? Let me get Susan and Andrew just briefly, because we're going to start wrapping up.
Sure. So, briefly, you know, when we have done our research, which has included, you know, extensive focus groups as well as third-party surveys and so forth in multiple languages for California, we certainly look at many of the issues that Bob has described, but the issue of affordability comes down to a few things. One is people don't know what affordable is. You know, when we talk to people about what they think it costs, in their minds it's, you know, $60 is a low price for broadband during the month, and most likely it's closer to $100. When you talk about a price for a computer, people are looking at something like $5,000, maybe $2,500. There is not a, you know, the technology cycles every 18 months, but the price does too. And this information, you know, the network isn't there for updating that information. So helping people understand what current prices are and that there is this cycle around technology, because most people's cell phone bills don't go down that same way, right? The cost of cell phones don't follow, interestingly enough, what computers have set up. It's also helping people understand the components are helping those of us sitting around the table understand what the components of affordability are. So when you talk to low-income people and families, it's signing a long-term contract is not compatible. Putting down $100 fees for, you know, either a modem or an installation cost doesn't work, is a deterrent. Doing credit checks is a deterrent. So there, the affordability is a package of items that you really have to unbundle with the communities and helping people, again, understand what the prices are. Part of what we have done is make refurbished computers much more available, and, you know, we're talking $150 to $200, so cost-effective and readily available. Helping people understand what the opportunities are for repair. We found a lot of people, in fact, have computers, but, you know, they've gotten some virus, somebody's downloaded something and something stopped working, and so, you know, it's serving as another piece of furniture for something else or sitting in the closet collecting dust. And people won't go to the Best Buys and these types of places for repairs. So building up that infrastructure on a community level has also helped. Helping people understand they can apply for the earned income tax credit, you know, for up to 3 years back and use those funds to pay for things. Helping people understand cost savings that are available online as a result of becoming digitally literate, whether it's Skype or Google Voice or coupons. I mean, there are any number of ways. So we developed the top 10 ways to save money, you know, online. And so those are how we have addressed affordability and, I think, broken through to
very helpful, Susan. Thanks so much. I want to make sure we get some people time here, Andrew, so if you could just bring us to our close here with some concluding remarks.
Sure. Yeah, I think the sort of the issue of understanding need is an interesting one, because I have to admit, when we were applying for this funding for public computing centers, I was kind of skeptical that people would go sometimes as far as a mile outside of their homes to use a computer. And clearly they do, because our numbers are really high, and the people are coming sometimes from quite a ways away just to use these machines and the internet. So I think you'd maybe benefits of the program eventually would be that you need fewer public computing centers because you've gotten people to adopt the internet and get a connection in their homes. And probably another desirable outcome from this program would be that there are more potentially lower cost options for connectivity in the home other than the ones that are currently provided by some of the bigger providers, which are, I don't know, Clear is about 50. I don't know about the other ones. That's what I have. But it's, I think, that seems affordable to me and many of you, right? But I think a lot of the clients we're serving are some of the poorest of the poor, and they need a much lower monthly rate for that than $50. So ideally we would get some competition going among the providers to figure out what that sort of cost threshold is, if they can make it or make some sort of a profit and serve this very underserved urban market.
Well, I certainly hope Tim will invite us back in a few years to see what's happened in some of these communities, because as I said earlier, I really think these projects have the potential to be really game changers in communities that are starting to fall behind in terms of economic development and opportunity. And, you know, obviously, you don't have to take my word for it with these five case studies up here. I think we've just heard some tremendous stories and information about already the tremendous things that are happening across the country as a result of these investments. I did want to say that we've gone over time, unfortunately, so we're not going to have time for Q&A. But we'll all be around here for a few minutes so we can meet outside. I've been instructed to tell you that there's coffee and cookies available in the foyer area until 2:30, which is a tremendous benefit of coming to the conference. So please join me in thanking the panelists for their time. And please come up if you have any questions before we